This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing, my chance to talk with artists, policymakers, and performers, to hear their stories, what inspires their creations, what decisions changed their careers, what relationships influenced their work. My guest today is actor Viggo Mortensen. He was relatively unknown when he appeared in Peter Jackson's The Lord of the Rings trilogy. As the warrior King Aragorn, Mortensen brought an earthy realism to a fantasy world filled with elves and wizards. The overwhelmingly successful films changed the course of Mortensen's career, and he shot to global stardom. His latest film is about a very different kind of fantasy. Captain Fantastic is the story of a father trying to raise his six children outside of conventionality, and what happens when that fantasy collapses. Mortensen himself was raised on three different continents, and he says his own imagination was formed at an early age.
Maybe because when that happens to you, when you're uprooted a lot, your fantasy world becomes a little more intense. You know, you replace the friends that you have to say goodbye to all the time with maybe imaginary friends.
And you moved a lot when you were young.
Yeah, I did. I mean, the kids in the movie they're isolated from other people, that's for sure. They're, you know, as you see in the beginning, they're in the middle of the forest. The youngest of them have never met other people, and they're used to just being very self-sufficient. But yeah, when I was a kid, we did move around a lot, and I grew up in a sort of multicultural environment, and maybe that.
What did your dad do?
He was he's raised on a farm. He's Danish, and farm boy, sort of self-made. He left home during high school. He didn't even finish high school. But then he met my mom, who's from the U.S., who was working in Norway, and fell in love and got married, and he moved here, and he decided, well, I'm going to be a businessman. And so he taught himself English and somehow got himself into a business school here and did 4 years' worth of study in 2 years, you know, very driven while my mom was working and supporting himself. And then when I was born in 1958 in New York, we moved to South America because that's where he got a job.
And do you have a lot of vivid memories of growing up down there, living down there?
Yeah, yeah. When I was little, we lived in urban settings in Buenos Aires and also in the country. My dad, just like his dad had taught him when I was very young, my brothers and I all went camping with him a lot, went to wild places, hunting, fishing, all that. So those things were not entirely
unfamiliar. How many brothers do you have?
I have two.
Oh, and are they in the business as well?
No, they studied geology. So, quite different. Although they're good, they're musicians, and I would have felt the youngest one. He was sort of very good mimic, and you know, very gifted in that way. And I, you know, if you would have guessed when we were little boys, if one of them was going to be an actor, it probably would have been him, not me.
Right? Yeah. What would they have guessed you would have been? A horse trainer?
I don't, maybe. No, someone who was, spent a lot of time by himself, probably. I had friends, not a lot of them. I had a couple good friends, and then maybe because of this itinerant thing. But I didn't really, I wasn't very social, I guess, and I was kind of shy about, I mean, I would have never imagined trying out for a play or a musical.
So how did that happen? How did someone who, I mean, because you seem so private and so...
Well, actually, I did have one experience. I think it was junior high or something. Once we moved to the United States, a friend of mine was really into the idea of becoming an actor, and he loved musicals, and he was just really, he knew everything about the theater in New York. And he said, you got to try it for this play. It's great. It's called, I think it was Hello, Dolly. And he goes, you got to try out for this. And I said, what? No, I can't. You imagine me trying out for Hello, Dolly?
Viggo Mortensen's debut is Hello, Dolly.
Yeah, right. And so I go, well, what do I got to do? He says, you go there and you go on the stage and, you know, in the auditorium, and then you just, they'll give you something to read, or you bring something to read. I don't remember how it was. In any case, I went out very unwillingly out on the stage, and there's this, you know, the theater teacher and whoever else was there. And I read the first paragraph from David Copperfield, or tried to, but every three words they'd say, louder, louder, and I just would shrink and shrink and shrink. And I finally just closed the book and ran off. And that was my only foray, other than I think in Argentina when I was like six, they put me in a play, George and the Dragon. And I was the ass end of the dragon. It was just a gray suit, felt or
it's
something.
Hello Dolly or the ass end of the dragon.
That's it.
It sounds like my career.
That's our.
So, how does it begin for you? Meaning, the person who is shy and private and likes to spend time with himself. How does he cross that divide?
Well, at a, I guess, a relatively late age, 21, 22, something like that.
Where were you then?
I was in Denmark. I have a lot of family, a lot of cousins and stuff. And I had a girl that I liked there, and I had different jobs, you know, pretty, you know, like manual labor kind of jobs, factory, dock worker. Best one was selling flowers on the street. That was nice. I always liked to see movies. My mom, when I was little, used to take me to pretty grown-up movies. You know, I remember Dr. Zhivago or to see, you know, these long movies with intermissions. Ben-Hur, Lawrence of Arabia. And I loved that. I loved the experience of seeing the movies with her and through her and talking with her in the intermission. And, of course, you'd also get a piece of chocolate in the intermission. That was not bad. And but the whole, she really was into that. And had she been, you know, she was typical mom from our parents' generation, meaning that she's the one you saw all the time, and your dad would leave early and come home late. And you might see him at dinner, but maybe not. Maybe not even to be tucked in. But you'd see him on the weekend.
Are they both still alive?
My dad is. Yeah, my mom passed away last year.
Sorry. And, you're close with her.
Very, yeah.
Where was she?
At the end, you mean?
Yeah.
In back where she was from, in Watertown, New York. So I made the circle
It's funny you say that. You said Watertown.
Yeah.
Because my family, my mother's family is from Syracuse.
Oh, really?
We spent a lot of time up in Pulaski, Watertown, Lake Ontario, Selkirk Shores, Sandy Pond. My whole childhood was in that area.
Oh, yeah. It's a beautiful area. Anyway, yeah. And so.
So you wouldn't see your dad?
I wouldn't see my dad so much, but except for...
Did your mother take the other boys to the movies too, or just you?
I mean, later we all went with her sometimes, but there was, I don't know, I had a special connection with the movies through my mom. I'm not saying more than my brothers, you'd have to ask them, but that's my recollection. I mean, I think what I was saying about her generation is, had she not been a at-home mom, I think she would have probably tried acting because she was outgoing and very beautiful, and she knew and cared a lot about movies. And when I first started out, you know, I'd call her. So what have you been doing? What do you try out for this week? And I'd say, well, just saying. Who wrote the script? I don't know. They just gave me 4 pages. It's just I got like 3 lines. So how are you going to play it? I go, I don't even have the part yet. I got to go in. who's the director? You know, who's in it? I go,
you wear a tie or no tie? You think you wear a tie?
Yeah. You know, are you going to limp?
She's on it.
A limp mustache, fake mustache, whatever, all this stuff.
Maybe he has a patch on his eye.
And if I'd say, well, I think the director's name is, and I would say, oh, yeah, yeah. He's not very good, but you never know. Is the part good? You know, I stopped sort of telling her so much. Unless I had the part, then we could talk. But because it was very irritating. Now, of course, I realize she really cared. One of the most enjoyable experiences I've had in recent years in the movie business was there was 1 year. It's like this, as you know, it's a crapshoot. The thing with awards and nominations. And then when you're nominated, well, this year they got it right. This year it's legitimate. Yeah. No, I knew it was kind of.
They figured it out finally.
Yeah, there was 1 year where I got nominated for all the sort of the SAG and the Golden Globes and the Oscars and all those in one. And so I said to my mom, do you want to go to, I think there was a strike, so the Golden Globes were canceled. There was no ceremony, but the SAG Awards were coming up. I said, that could be nice. I think it's tables and it's like more relaxed. Do you want to go, Mom? Sure, of course. I was waiting. I thought you'd never ask. I said, well, I've never been nominated before. She goes, okay, well, yes, I'll go. I'm going to get a new dress or a pantsuit or something. I said, well, whatever you want. Do you want some help? No. That's something. That's my area. And I said, fine. So she got her thing. She flew down. At that point, she was living in northern Idaho where I was lived. She'd moved there and lived near my brother and long story. But so she came down to Los Angeles. I picked her up at the airport. We came the day before and We hung out and talked. She had lots of questions about who's going to be there. I don't know, Mom. And this and that. And who else is nominated? And then I told her who was nominated. She goes, oh, he did that and he did that. She's like, encyclopedia. And then we go to the thing. And as you know, there's this red carpet thing. I said, well, I got to talk to these journalists on the way in. And then if you don't mind, no, I'll just stand over here and watch and see how you do. I'm like, okay. So it was kind of, I knew she was behind me. So she watches. And we walk in, and then she's muttering, oh, you did okay, except for that one lady. You seemed like you didn't like her. I said, well, the questions were kind of dumb. It doesn't matter. You got to be polite to all of them. I'm like, yeah, okay. So we sit down, and it is tables, and she immediately goes, oh, that's – and all the older actors and people that I didn't know who they were, she knew exactly who they were. He was in this, and he was in that. In 1948, he did everything. And oh, and that's John Travolta. I go, yes, it is. And he goes, excuse me. And she gets up and she goes and just starts talking to him. And she did that all night. It was great.
It was a fantasy.
I loved it. And she loved it. And she had a really good time. And I had been asked, I'd never done this, to present one of the awards at night, which is a nerve-wracking thing. I was like, I would rather just learn it. No, you should read the thing. So you just, I don't know what it was, Best Supporting Actress, I think. And yeah, and there was a sort of gentle critique of my delivery when I came back to the table. You know, it was just like that kind of night. But I laughed a lot. It was wonderful. And I wish I had been nominated before that, just so that I could have taken my mom to all of them.
She could have enjoyed it.
It would have been wonderful. I took my mom to quite a few premieres. She liked that. And or either took her or she attended, you know. Sometimes ones I wasn't, you know, like if I couldn't be at the one in New York City, she would come down from Syracuse. But there was one that was really fun. I did a movie called Hidalgo.
I love that movie.
It's a Disney movie.
And
Omar Sharif is in it. And of course, she took me when I was little to see Dr. Zhivago and Lawrence of Arabia. And so she had a crush on him like back then. And maybe her whole life, I don't know. And she came with my stepdad.
You know, you look a little like Omar Sharif. It's funny you should say that.
At this time of day.
You kind of look like him a little bit. It's weird. Anyway.
So in the morning, thank you, Howard. she came with my stepdad, and it was kind of a crazy premiere in L.A. I actually came down the red carpet on the horse. It was raining. They were like, don't gallop, because if you slide under a bus and the horse get hurt, and if you get hurt, they added sort of as a P.S., that would be terrible for us and, you know, the insurance, I don't know. So don't worry, I'll just trot in. So I did, and the photographers were kind of shocked, and I rode up right up to them, and they started asking questions. I said, I don't know, ask him, and it was kind of just silly like that. And my mom's there, you know, my stepdad, beaming, and I get off the horse, and I walk over to her, and then I spot Omar. And I go, look, Mom. And she goes, that's him. And I said, well, you want to meet him? No, no, no. I go, yeah, come on. And I had told Omar that my mom really was into him, you know, when we were shooting the thing. And he just, like, put on the suave gentleman. He was suddenly looked like
they
Omar from
that.
1963. And he comes over and he takes her hand so gently, just never removing his eyes from hers, and kissed her hand so slowly. She was like beet red. And my stepdad, I thought he was going to knife him. I mean, he was so upset. I mean, he didn't say anything, but he was just like, I thought he's going to have a coronary. And that was like a highlight. She was just beaming. The rest of the night, it was like she'd been given some kind of, you know, drug or something.
I had the same thing with my sister. I was doing this movie, The Edge, with Tony Hopkins, and we were in the Canadian wilderness.
Tony's, the one about with the bear.
With the bear in the woods, yeah. It was the best experience I've ever had making a film, because I worship Tony. I was just the dream of working with Tony, and I thought, oh, God, what if I ever had that chance?
Yeah.
I just loved him, and here I was making this film, and my sister... My older sister, who at the time was married, has six children, you know, she's a pretty solid citizen. She comes up to Canada to see me. Tony's laying on an air mattress because he'd hurt his back. And right soon after this, we were going to shut down for 2 weeks for him to have back surgery, where, like, go in your neck and fix his bones and everything. And he's lying there reading the paper, and my sister walks up, and I go, Tony, I'd like you to meet my sister Beth. And Tony stands up, fluffs his clothes, and then right, like a movie, he like just looks up at her and makes eye contact with her and says, Elizabeth, what a great pleasure to meet you. and takes her hand and does the same exact
kisses
thing, the
it.
Slow kiss on the hand. And my sister turned red. She started like trembling a little bit because she worshiped Tony. And I thought, these guys just, they got it, man. They know exactly
She walks
what
away
doing.
And he's done for the day, right? He's like totally killed himself doing that.
Now, for you, you were going to give me the where you crossed that line and the very quiet private kid goes into the business.
Yeah.
22 years old.
I guess I started looking. I mean, I'd seen some on TV, but I hadn't really seen many. I mean, in Argentina, I'd seen Argentine movies because that's what you had down there. Mostly American movies, like it happens everywhere in the world, but I'd see stuff in Argentina. I mean, I thought cartoons on TV were from there because they were dubbed. And then I got here when I was 11 and I'm like looking at Yogi Bear and, you know, Speed Racer and so on. Oh, these are not Argentine. These are actually
Gigantor.
Yeah, even the Batman TV show, you know, with Adam West and all that. I thought
you were the same age. It's the same cartoon.
Yeah, it's like this. It's all in English. What's wrong? You know, and but I hadn't been exposed to, let's say, movies from other countries and from the 40s, 50s, certainly not silent movies. And all of a sudden, I started watching lots of. Was in Denmark. It was a time where I was spending time in England and Denmark and different jobs. And I started going to revival movie houses where you'd see a couple different movies a day if you wanted to. And I started seeing, you know, movies by Ozu and Bresson and Pasolini and Dreyer and before that. And it was an eye-opener. And I, at some point, I made the transition from being entertained or not, you know, going for just to enjoy myself, to wondering what the trick was. I mean, how do they do that? How is it that I relate to them and then suddenly I'm crying? I'm sitting in a movie theater crying, or that I walk out of the movie theater and I'm shocked that I'm in Copenhagen or that I'm in a city and it's daytime. I'm not, you know, on the Mongolian plains or something.
You're not on the raft in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah. And I was curious about how is that done? And not long after that, I moved to Manhattan.
From Denmark?
Yeah. There was a girl I was going out with at the time. She went back here, and I followed her. And that didn't work out. But I got here. I was with her for a while, and I was curious about the acting thing. I wanted to try it just to see, you know. How does it work? So I got a phone book. I looked on the Yellow Pages.
You got
to go to a theater and try out for the play. But what theater, right? So I'm leafing through and I find this thing that says Actors Repertory Theater, which was really a workshop. It was Warren Robertson as a teacher, right? And so I love Actors Repertory Theater. That sounds good. I know repertory means they could be doing several plays. And maybe if I get in the first one, then I do okay. I could be in other plays. That's probably the play. So I call them and they go, Actors Repertory Theater. You know, and I go, How do you try out for the play? And they go, what play? And I go, well, you know, are there auditions? Sure, you can come down 8:15 Monday. You can come down. You might want to get here a few minutes early just to sign in. I go, okay, what do I do? Bring two pieces. I'm like, two pieces of what? And they said, two texts, you know. Oh, text. And like, you know, I go to act. And they go, yes. So I had no idea what that meant. So at the time, I was reading a collection of short stories.
Your career relies on the patience of this woman on that phone, boy.
Exactly.
She was very kind to you.
Yes. Isaac Dinas and Karen Blixen, the Danish writer, I was reading some short stories. There's one in which Jack the Ripper figures, and there's some dialogue. So I sort of cobbled together the dialogue from the short story and made a little monologue out of that. And then I found an Irish song, or there's an Irish song I liked, old Irish song. So I came in and I did this weird Jack the Ripper monologue and sang this song. And they just sat there for a while, looked at each other, and they said, we'll get back to you. And I go, that's it? They go, yep, next, you know, like that. So I went back home, and I thought, well, I don't know if that went well or not. And the next day they called, and they said, you can come in next Wednesday. I go, what's the play? And they go, there is no play. Just come in next Wednesday. It turned out it was a theater workshop where you know, scene study and acting exercises. It was Warren Robertson had his approach was kind of a combination of Sandy Meisner and Actor's Studio, you know, Sense Memory and Scene Study. And
did you like it right away?
I did like it. Well, the main thing was that he encouraged me. Had he not,
Warren.
Yes, Had he not said, no, there's something, I mean, I was probably really doing weird stuff. You know, he would say, you're just too fidgety. You're all over the place. I want you to sit on your hands and do all that now without moving around so much. And he was just, I think it was probably very crude, but he saw something and he sort of eventually recommended me to go meet an agent and stuff. And if he hadn't encouraged me, it might have been just one more thing I tried. I'm not sure. But, and I certainly, I mean, I got lucky right away once I went out for auditions in terms of getting to, down to the last two guys for parts. But I did that about 30 times and I never would get it. And I was always shocked. I was like, well, I did my best. Why don't I, you know? But something about it, maybe whatever my mom had inculcated or put into me.
Or maybe just some voice inside you that told you, you need to find out.
Yeah,
you need to find
stay
out.
With it. I still was like, I like the idea of telling stories in the movies. I want to do it. So I just stuck with it and eventually got little parts. It's probably for me, because I'm a slow learner in a way. I mean, once I learn something, I'm not going to forget it. But the process of auditioning many times and seeing how people shoot stuff and how, you know, tests, screen tests, all kinds of stuff, and then getting small parts, doing a little theater, a little TV, and small parts in movies, I really learned how process works. I got, you know, a couple good parts, very small, like one scene parts, one with Woody Allen, Purple Rose of Cairo, one with Jonathan Demme, Swing Shift. Both of those were cut out of the movies, to my surprise, and my family's when I told them next Friday I'm in the movie, and they're like, what are you doing in New York
City? I'm in the movie, but I'm not in the movie.
Yeah, my name's nowhere, yeah.
I promise, I made the scene with Woody.
Yeah, so I was in Search for Tomorrow, which was the oldest. Which one did you do?
I did The Doctors before they got, but Search, Edge, we always called them by one word when I was on Search, Edge, Days.
Search was a very old one, and I went in, they put me in this white paramedic kind of outfit, and they said, you guys are gonna, when it's time, we'll practice just before, because it's a narrow door, and you put the actress on the stretcher, then you can't make like a full turn with the stretcher and all that, just have that in mind. I'm like, okay. And then it was like, hurry up and wait. So I was down there in the little cubicle that they put me in my white outfit, and my hair sort of slicked back a little bit, and I fell asleep. And all of a sudden, the bell's ringing. Like, come on, Morton, where's Mortensen? And then we had to shoot. I didn't get to rehearse. I didn't know what was going on. So the guy goes, well, you take the back end, always the ass end, of the stretcher, and just follow where I go. Okay, I go, fine. I'm like sort of half asleep. And backing up, I hit the set, and the wall was moving. It was just terrible. I didn't get that call back to that one. But Search for Tomorrow, I had a good run. I was on it for a few months, and played a smuggler. It's kind of a mysterious guy. I never found out what he was smuggling. I would ask, and it's like, too many questions, Morton. What am I smuggling? It's not. It's contraband. I go, well, what is the? Is it drugs? Not important. Yeah. You're just smuggling. The main thing is you don't tell anybody. I said, I won't. And they finally, I think, got tired of my questions a few months in, because I'd say, well, why is this? And if I'm going to, you know, I was in the hospital at one point. And then I did the thing where you tie the sheets together and climb out the window. And I don't know, I asked questions about where'd all these sheets come from? I mean, it's a lot.
I'm going to need about 11 or 12 sheets to pull this off. You know,
this knot is not strong enough.
Well, it says that we're on the ninth floor.
Exactly.
Am I the only one who sees that?
Exactly. I said, these knots are not strong enough. This would never hold. You know, and they're like, Morton, just throw it out the window and jump out. Okay.
Fling yourself out the window.
So after so many questions, one day I was informed, it's the end for you on Wednesday. I said, the end? The end what? The end of your employment here. But it's going to be a great scene. And it was a silly scene. It was a bar, and there was a girl that hit me with a, you know, breakable glass, a pitcher of beer in the forehead. And I fall out of shot. And that was it.
And that was it for Viggo Mortensen's soap opera career. Coming up, his film career explodes. Take a listen to the Here's the Thing archives. I talk with actresses like Debbie Reynolds, who remembers living in Hollywood during the golden era.
Right across the street was Jimmy Stewart and Lucille Ball, and everybody was on that one street. It was like, let's have a party every night.
Listen to the full conversation at hearsthething.org. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Viggo Mortensen isn't just an award-winning actor. He's also an avid writer, artist, and publisher. He speaks fluent English, Danish, Spanish, and French, but his first movie offer was a one-day role as an Amish farmer speaking German in Peter Weir's 1985 film Witness. He wasn't sure if he should take it on the very day he was offered the role in Witness.
That same day I was offered a part in a Shakespeare in the Park production. And I said to my representative, well, obviously do the play. I mean, I can work all summer and learn stuff. He goes, not so fast. He said, you know, for an actor living in New York and, you know, in the early 80s, it wasn't even now, but especially then, you don't get that. It's not like you have that many shots at being in movies. And you're certainly not going to be offered work by Peter Weir very often. So take advantage. You can always do a play. You're in New York. So I recommend you do that, even if it's only the one day. So I go down, I take the train down to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and I do my first day's work. And as luck would, and it was fun. It was a beautiful place. And at lunch, Peter Weir comes over and says, you know, you have a vague resemblance. I'm thinking, well, what are you doing tomorrow? I go, I'm taking the train back to New York. He goes, well, are you doing anything this summer, the rest of the summer? I go, not now. And he says, well, if you wouldn't mind staying, you know, for a few weeks, maybe more, I think I'm going to give Alexander Goodenough, the Amish suitor of Kelly McGillis, Harrison Ford's rival for her affections in the story, we're going to give him a younger brother, and you just tag along, and the scenes he's in, you're just watching this rivalry. You're the audience's eyes, I guess, and we'll figure it out. Okay, and I go, sure. So that was a good break, and it was very professional. They always finished on time. The weather was nice, but the cinematographer was brilliant, John Seal. The actors were prepared, and the director, nobody yelled. It was fun. Anybody could go to watch the rushes, the dailies.
So it was misleading in its...
It was misleading because everybody was professional and behaved well and kind to each other, and they did good work, and they finished on time, and it was not stressful. So I don't know about your experience, but in my experience, that's very unusual.
Right. A very famous actor, I don't want to speak about anybody without their permission, but told me that he did a film that was very tough that way, and the director was very, very, you know, just luxuriating in 35 and 40 takes without any real direction, you know, without any real purpose, and kind of abusive to some of the other cast, at the very least psychologically, in the way he would say things and do things. And it was all not at all what he was used to or preferred. And so he just went up to the guy and rather than get angry, he just really said it like as a plea. He said, I just can't work like this. Mm-hmm. And if you want me to do what I do, this situation's got to change.
Yeah,
I like to do 6 or 8 takes. You like to do 30 takes, 35 takes. He said, I don't work that way. So he said, I'm going to go home.
And cut out the yelling.
And cut out this, you know, kind of dressing everybody down in front of the crew and crew members. He said, when you want to speak to somebody, you give them their notes privately. Don't do it and embarrass them.
Right.
So the point is that the actor said to the director, you guys think about it. And he goes, I'm going to go home. And then tomorrow, if I come back, if you want me to come back, I'm going to come back knowing that it's different. And if I don't come back, you're going to get another actor to play this part who's going to put up with what I'm putting up with now that I don't want to put up with anymore. He just said it really calmly.
And what happened?
And when the guy changed and just, you know, was everybody was a little bit more. There were times you could see the guy was struggling. He didn't change his nature.
Had the power, had the position or the size role that he could do that. Yeah. And if you're playing a bit part, it's like, you're done. You're out.
Yeah.
You know, I think the main thing, the most important thing to be, apart from just listening in general, it's good in life too, but for an actor, be flexible. You know, once you realize that there's all kinds of ways of making movies, good and bad, pleasant and unpleasant, that doesn't mean you can't do your job. Sometimes it's more difficult than others, but the best thing is to be, there's different ways. Some people like to rehearse, some people don't. Some actors come in, and some of them are very good, award-winning actors that shall not be named, but they can prepare technically, let's say in front of a mirror, whatever they do. They know how they're going to, the tone of every line. They know at what moment in the scene they're going to cry or seem to or laugh. There's nothing wrong with it, but that means that you're adapting to them. you know. I mean, I've tried, but it doesn't go, you know, just for the hell of going, blah, blah, blah. And there's like, they're just impassive because they know when the camera's on them, it doesn't matter what the hell you're doing. If you're working that way, it's, this is what I'm delivering. You guys adjust to me. That can work and that person can do a great job. It's just not as much fun because there isn't the unknown. There isn't, you're not playing together. It's not a two-way street. And that works. So when you work with someone like that, well, you just deal with it. If you get resentful, then you're out of your game. It's like someone trying to psych you out on the basketball court or, you know, or something. You can't, if you let that happen, you're not going to play well.
But what's a movie you did that's the opposite, where everybody really, really did play off it and was very crackling and very alive with?
I've been lucky. I've been in several. I would say Captain Fantastic, this movie that's just come out. That was a great experience. The director was calm. That was very much like Peter Weir or like Cronenberg, where everything's done. Everybody's well prepared. Everybody's polite to each other. The director has a good sense of humor. They're intelligent enough to know that it's good to do everything possible to give the actors the idea. It's a lie, basically, but to give the actors the idea that there's, especially when you're working with children, in this movie you have six kids, that there's, you have all the time in the world. It's just fun. It's just, there's no pressure. And inside, the director's like freaking out as the sun's going down, and you're on an independent movie of limited budget, limited schedule.
How many days did you shoot?
It was 30-something days, 30.
That's not too bad.
30,
in the
that's
world.
Not bad, but when you look at Captain Fantastic, we had a lot
very
of changes
ambitious.
Of locations.
Yeah, I saw that.
And all these
I
kids.
I watched that very carefully.
And some of the kids are, I mean, the kids have limited work hours, 5-6 hours for the youngest. And
it's a longer
breaks.
Movie, too, in indie terms. Everybody tries to get, kind of wrap it up in an hour and 30 now, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
This one ran a little longer than that, but an hour 50.
Exactly. And so that was a good experience. And, I mean, he's the captain. He or she runs the show, and their example is what guides everyone else. Catherine Hahn, Steve Zahn, very good actors, Frank Langella, and Dowd. I mean, everybody. And it was a great group of people, and I think Matt selected people who would work that way.
I was so hoping that there would be an earthquake and a beam would come down and crush Langella's character. I hated him so much in the movie.
Yeah, but at the end, you kind of realize, he's got a point, you know? He's not all wrong. I mean,
he's got his point, yeah.
Yeah, one of the things I like about the movie is that it surprises you. It subverts your expectations. And just like when I was reading the script, I thought, wow, this is good. And I had my pencil because I know the director wanted to meet me, so I wanted to make my notes, so... You know, and I didn't make any notes. I just started reading. And the first 10, 15 pages, I thought, okay, I know what this is. It's a kind of a subgenre. It's a, I guess, a liberal utopian fantasy story where these are our heroes are these left-wing, off-the-grid people, and their obstacles will be conservative people, conservative ideas. And we'll go with them through thick and thin and see how that works. It'll probably be funny. And
convention will be there.
Right. And... And then I realize it's not that. And you go from thinking, well, it's the best dad in the world. I feel like a lazy bum, you know, watching this family. You know, they're so driven to, you know, to achieve physical and intellectual excellence every second of the day. It's an incredibly devoted father, to thinking he's a maniac. He's a menace to his children.
He's a danger
to society.
Right.
And he's, you know, the very rigidity that he's so against, he's engaging in it inadvertently, maybe, by being isolating them and being so rigorous. And then the characters that you think are going to be, you know, like Frank Langella's character and his wife, Ann Dowd, you think they're going to be just bad and sort of one note. And in reality, they have a point. They and his children, circumstances, lead the character that I play to realize I'm on the wrong path. And it's devastating. When you, as a parent, do what he does. If you give 100% of your time and energy, you do everything to help, you know, curate the lives of your children, to give them the best possible start. You're sacrificing everything. And your first impulse is to feel like it's all wrong. I'm an idiot and I quit. And then he makes an adjustment. And as an audience, I like those stories. Just reading, I thought, this is really good. I was really surprised. I closed the script and thought, wow, that's amazing. I haven't made a single note. I went to meet Matt Ross, the writer-director, for a cup of coffee, which lasted like 4.5 hours. We're talking about being dad.
Always a good sign.
Everything, you know, politics.
And you are a dad.
Yeah.
You have a
28-year-old son.
Son, where is he?
He's in Los Angeles.
What's he do?
He's a musician. He's a writer, and he also works part time at Percival Press, a company, a publishing house I have.
That you have.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. You know, when I saw the film, it just reminded me that I have a daughter who's going to be 21 in October, and and I was not involved in raising her as much as I'd like to because I was divorced and everything, and it was a little complicated. But and when I watched the film, I realized that, well, here's a guy that really wants to raise his kids himself. And what I realized watching you is that, you know, we don't raise our children. You know, we try. We really try. We try so hard to superimpose our sensibilities. And here's a guy who he really wants to be their father in the sense that he's going to determine what gets put into the mix and what doesn't. And in the world we live in now, especially now, I mean, right now, that's impossible. I mean, how much we actually raise our children is almost ridiculously small.
Because of technology.
Because of the world.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing I got from the story, too, and I got from the script is that it's aspirational, that really it's basically to be the perfect parent is impossible. And and the story isn't showing you something to make you think, well, you should be there 100% of the time. It's just whether you're engaged or not. And to know that by taking the risk of trying hard, you're going to make mistakes. And then the most important thing is hopefully realizing that and doing something about it and making adjustments. You know, being a good dad isn't a static thing. Having a good marriage isn't a static thing. Neither is a democracy. Neither is a friendship. You know, tomorrow morning you got to sort of start over. Not over, but continue the process and make adjustments. And if you don't,
prepare for the change.
Yeah, it's a game that moves as you play. And if you don't move, you can't play very well.
So scripts for you, how do scripts get to you? Was there a mechanism? I think people would be fascinated to know someone who has made as many successful films, highly successful films as you've had. You're very admired by everybody in the business, and you must get inundated with scripts. And is there a filter? Like, how do you get a script and say, the one you open and the one you read, how does it arrive at your home?
Well, in that regard, I don't like filters at all. And my representative has always known that. So I said, I will read everything and anything. And don't censor, just send it and read whatever you want to. I don't care, but I'm going to decide if I want to do it or not.
And sometimes you read 20, 30 pages and go, this is not there.
You know that, right. Yeah, most, I mean, I think it's been since movies began as an art form, 95% or more of the scripts that are written are not original, or if they start well, or maybe there's an okay concept, it's just the structure. It just doesn't work. And most of them are really poorly written, not very good ideas. But it does take longer to look at everything. And so that's the conventional way. They come through, you know, an agent sometimes. But a lot of times people will hand me stuff on the street or through a family member or friend. You know, you've probably, you know, somebody says, well, would you look at this? Or you're going to...
I try to avoid it if I can.
I know, you're going to opening of a movie and you're doing an interview and suddenly goes, here! And you hand it a package and you're like, well, I will look at them and I will answer, but... It's also like with the publishing house I have. You know, I announced that we're not taking unsolicited submissions for the foreseeable future. We have enough projects in the hopper to work on.
Why did you set up a publishing house?
I like books, and I like artists. I like writers, and there were certain people that I thought ought to be published. After Lord of the Rings, for me and for everyone else, all of a sudden there was this new. I had more options as an actor suddenly. I mean, people have the mistaken impression that as an actor you can choose. Well, why didn't you do that? I said, well, they didn't offer it to me. You can say no, but you can't say yes unless they're offering it. But people think, why aren't you James Bond? I'm like, I never heard from the James Bond people.
Yeah.
And so I just thought, well, I'll use the money and more than that, the notoriety that I suddenly have as a result of the success of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, I'll establish this publishing house. And to help it, the first year I'll put out a book, maybe two of my own photographs, things, poems, and then that'll lead them to the other things on the website and I enjoy it. I think it must be like directing, I suppose, in the sense that you're enabling other people. You're facilitating their way of looking at things.
I'm curious as to you do Carlito with Brian, who mm-hmm. I love, and you do G.I. Jane. You do the Psycho remake. You do a bunch of things. When you arrive, where it's Peter Jackson directed the first film as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when Jackson contacts you, where are you at in your career when at that point where you're on the threshold of doing the biggest movies you've ever made?
It's 99. I had just finished making a movie that ended up being called 28 Days. And I'd bought a pickup truck and I'd driven across the country with my son, who was 11 at the time. We had this great road trip where he made a map. He drew a map of the United States and I said, well, let's decide the route rather than going straight across the country to California where we were living at the time. I said, what places should we go? I said, well, how about Graceland? Okay, we made that dot on the map. And then how about where mom's family's from? I go, that would be near Chicago. And then, well, how about, Uncle Michael? Okay, that's Tucson. Okay, and how about this? And how about, So there was all these places all over. So we did, and I said, well, this is what the line looks like. It's like this is
the stock market.
Yeah, exactly, crashing, falling, going up and down, north, south, but always sort of more or less working westward. And we got back from that, school starts, and I was up in Idaho, actually, when I got this phone call. And somebody said, well, we would like you to come and do this movie. And I said, I just got back with my son and school started. And I haven't read that book. I don't know anything about it. And you guys are already shooting. It was to replace an actor, which is also an awkward thing, and who was deemed to be too young for the role. And I said, nah, I don't know. My son heard me talking about it. And he said, Lord of the Rings. He knew what it was from his friends. And I'd read The Hobbit years before in high school, but I didn't know anything about Lord of the Rings. I just knew it was this big, huge book. And he said, what's the character? And I go, oh, it's a guy, I don't know, some guy's in the woods, and he's got, some little people that he's guiding around. And he goes, that's Strider. I go, yeah, right. And he goes, and he becomes the king. I go, he does? He goes, yeah. He becomes king, yeah. And I go, you should do that. I go, but it's a long, I haven't read it, and they've been rehearsing for months and all their stuff, and elvish and swordplay and whatnot. I don't think it's just sometimes you got to admit you're not the right guy for the job, whatever. And he goes, I don't know. So I hung up, but I thought about it, and he was very for it. Maybe I would have done it on my own anyway, but I was curious. And also on the phone, they're going, it'd be easy, we'll be done by December. And here it's October. I go, oh, that's good, December of next year. I'm like, oh, shit. So I eventually said yes, and that's how that worked out. It was great. That was a good experience. I really liked that. There was something I was thinking about earlier. That yesterday I did this, sort of like a public forum, New York Times thing, where you're speaking in front of an audience. You're being asked
Times
questions.
Talks.
Exactly. And they asked me a question. I was curious about how you felt about this. They said, do you feel that the movies you do or choose to do or accept, that they need to be about something in terms socially? Do they have to be for the better good, or do they have to promote, I suppose politically or ideologically, something positive in your opinion? And I said, no, I don't think that. I find movies that are message movies to not be very effective dramas or comedies or anything. They're just not interesting to me. Movies like Captain Fantastic, rather, movies that actually indirectly, without intending to, make you think about communication problems, which mm-hmm. we have many in this country
Love.
Right now. That's great, because you're thinking you can apply it. Okay, well, people aren't talking, and if you don't talk and you're isolated in your groups because of ideology, race, whatever, it's a problem. You got to talk. You got to work it out. You have to be flexible. That's how I like it. But I don't message movies. No, I said. But what I was thinking, and the subject went on to something else, what I would have said if we talked about it further was that, I've heard the thing that you've probably heard before. Well, you're an actor. Why don't you keep your mouth shut? What do you know?
Right.
It's like, well, why doesn't a football player or an actor or a dentist or anybody in any part of the country have a right to say anything? It's supposed to be, if you can't expect your politicians to have a civil discourse, informed discourse, to be honest and to communicate better across the aisle or with citizens if you don't do it. The example has to come from below, not from above.
Right. Now, it's interesting to me when I think about you is, you know, you're this very chiseled leading man and you've got this warmth and this passion, this beauty to you in the current film, in Captain Fantastic. But in other films, you know, you're this anxious, tough. History of Violence was a tough movie.
Yeah.
And do you find when you make a film like that, is there some kind of a state you have to enter to play one or the other? Do you have to empty yourself out and get into the beauty zone and the love zone to do Captain Fantastic? And do you need to drink 19 espressos and be in your room watching Scarface on DVD when you step off to go shoot people in a movie?
No. I mean, you know, the other question that's sort of like that people say, well, what happens? How do you get rid of the character, you know, when you go home at night or when you're done shooting? And
I'm the opposite. How do you get into the character?
I mean, my job, as I see it, is I got to take on the point of view, understand it, and like it, you know, believe in the point of view of the character I'm playing. And I've played some characters that I wouldn't want to meet on the street, but and that I disagree with their point of view personally. But my job is to get into it. It's kind of the make-believe that you do without even thinking as a child. But as an adult, you have to work at it. And I find that endlessly interesting. It's like traveling mentally in your imagination. So, and getting into it.
It's fun.
Yeah. I mean, I naturally gravitate. I mean, when I played Sigmund Freud in A Dangerous Method, I just read everything that I had read of his and everything I hadn't read and essays and things about him, biographies. And I went to Vienna and I spent some time walking around. I went to places he was meant to have walked to all the time, cafes. I went to, I found books that I knew from research that he had in his library. I found edition. You know, it was just a whole, and maybe none of that is ever seen in the movie, but for me, it makes me feel like I've turned over every stone. And in the process of this sack that I fill with all these odd things, you never know what they are, even objects that maybe get used in the movie, learning how his, trying to copy his handwriting, all these things that you don't really have to do. But it's my getting ready. It's the fun part. And if I'm playing a dark kind of character, like you said, I take an interest. I might try to meet people like that or go to places they'd go to. And just naturally, not trying to, you can get into a mindset. That doesn't mean that I'm going to go home and
shoot somebody.
Yeah, or punch some pregnant woman in the belly or something, you know, just for fun. You know, I'm just...
I've actually did that in a movie. I kicked a pregnant woman in the belly in a movie. And found out
horrible.
She was faking. Well, she had a fake foam pad and she was pretending to be pregnant, which is why I kicked her. I knew she was faking.
Oh, my God. It must have been a horrible moment.
It was a horrible moment in the movie. I hated doing it. But my character could see through. He could tell she wasn't really pregnant by the way she was faking in this movie. But anyway... So the last thing I want to say to you is what someone – I admire Cronenberg endlessly.
Yeah.
I love his films.
Yeah.
He's such a great, great movie maker. And I love those three films and two in particular. I mean, History of Violence was just such an incredibly gripping movie.
Yeah.
And Ed and Hurt and all these really – and guys that are really just these very – people you can't take their eyes. The three of you together was like
exactly.
This Mount Rushmore, these really, really interesting guys in movies. And what does he do for you? What's something you like about Cronenberg, and how does he help you as a director when you work with somebody like him?
Well, he's not a director that likes to rehearse, but he's very careful and very good at casting. He's open to anybody's ideas. He's a sane, mature, sensible director. So we developed a shorthand right away, and I share kind of, I think, a similar sense of humor, similar interest in literature and movies, and we didn't need to talk much about, you know, I would do a take, and he might say, well, I'm happy, do you want to do another one? I'd say, yeah, I'll do a lot of takes, I like it. But if that's another thing about being flexible, some directors, some schedules only allow for a take or two. And what I've quickly realized with him is that, you know, let's say in that character, History of Violence, it's very subtle. Some of the transitions were because he's pretending to be someone else for years, so much so that he almost believes it. And so there's almost a sort of schizophrenic situation he has, and it's not a clean. He doesn't suddenly go from one guy to another. There's some little back and forth. You know, he's on the edge of that, and some of that's very subtle, and it's mostly nonverbal. When he's there's just a look in the eye or just a glance, and just like, oh, he's becoming that other character's peeking through that other person, his real self or one of his real selves. And, you know, I realized right away, like, we did the thing. I said, well, you know, it's not something said. He goes, no, I saw it. So you need a director who sees the thing.
Knows how to read you.
Takes care of it.
Knows how to read you.
Yeah, and all of, you know, and takes care of it in the editing room. So when he said, well, let's do Eastern Promises, I thought, sure, it'd be great. I was doubtful about the third one. He said, Sigmund Freud. I said, that's a stretch. I don't think any other director would have said play that, but it's him. So in the end, he hasn't steered me wrong so far.
I want to finish by saying you've played a lot of great roles as a result of your looks and, you know, masculinity and intensity, not just, you know, your physical features, but your whole essence. But to be on film and just exist on film and to respond, and this film really breathes. This movie is beautiful and breathes. The moment for me, and I'm not even assuming this was there for you, but the moment I thought is that Langella at one point in the film, two-thirds into the film, where he's just like suggesting, you're crazy.
Yeah.
You're nuts. And what I loved about you was that you really, what I got from you was you were like, maybe I am.
Yeah.
You sat there and go, oh my God, maybe I am crazy. And that was one of the most beautiful moments in the movie, that little interlude, you saying, oh God, maybe they're right.
Yeah.
Maybe I am crazy. Maybe I'm mentally ill.
I love characters that take you on that journey, and I love movies that, as an audience member, you're sitting here, and they really make you think, I'm doing it wrong. I mean, as a dad or just as a human being. I've got it all wrong. I'm lazy. I've treated people, I got to call my mom right away, or I got to talk to my children, or I've got to make up for that thing I did, or God, why did I choose this profession? What's wrong with me? I'm so lacking in integrity and effort and commitment. And, you know, movies that make you doubt everything, make you wake up and think everything I've done is wrong, even for a moment. Then, of course, you have to, hopefully you can get it together and make some adjustments. That's a great service that a movie story can do for you.
I watched a screening of Captain Fantastic, and I encourage you to see it too. It's playing in theaters now. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from WNYC Studios.